L. And they looked at the, they did an analysis of the asymptotic symmetries and the generators of those symmetries and so on. And they concluded that quantum gravity on ADS-3, just from an analysis of the symmetries, that the generators of the residual symmetry group formed reverse Haro algebra. Might not have all my signs right there. And they actually computed, using a completely classical analysis, the value of the central charge, and they found that it was equal to 3 times the radius of curvature of the anti-de Sitter space divided by twice the three-dimensional Newton's constant. Now, this, without using string theory, this result was in a sense recovered later using string theory. But without using string theory, this shows that three-dimensional anti-de Sitter space is a two-dimensional conformal field theory, because the Hilbert space is a representation of this algebra with this central charge, and that is by definition a two-dimensional conformal field theory. Now, it also, though they didn't understand it at the time, it also contained within it, or was almost to the calculation of the entropy of a black hole. Because, as we know, certain black holes have near horizon regions with this geometry. And just from using this value of the central charge, you can compute using Carde's formula the entropy of an excited state of this geometry. It's just 2 pi C L naught over 6. And if you, where this is the zero mode of the reverse Haro algebra, and if you plug all this in and you look at the excited states of, you look at the black hole solutions of three-dimensional gravity with negative curvature, you find that this agrees, that this microscopic entropy agrees with the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the macroscopic black hole solution. So this was a very, very, I don't think we fully appreciated or exploited it. Some of the things that we could have understood earlier from this point of view, we didn't, because many of us hadn't read the papers. But it's a very powerful and ultimately very simple observation. Now, it turns out, so in the intervening, in the last 10 years, it turns out that we've learned a lot about, various kinds of black holes and string theory and so on. But essentially every case, or maybe every case that we have understood, we've understood because there's some regime in parameter space for the black hole in which there's an ADS-3 factor, and then we can apply this Brown-Hinault formula and get the entropy. So, but it's not true. So almost everything we've done reduces to this. But it's not true that everything we want to do, we'd like to do, can be reduced to this. And we've been banging for 10 years at a number, and there seems to be a whole class of problems having to do with black holes that we haven't been able to solve. And it's exactly that class where we can't reduce it in this simple way to this computation. So a we just forget that one? Or okay, I'll just use this. Okay, so a more Now, ultimately, what we'd like to understand is the Schwarzschild black hole, but we should take little steps as we approach that goal. And I think a more modest goal at this time is to try to understand black holes that have ADS2 factors rather than ADS3 factors. And of course, what's simple about one of the things that's simple about black holes with ADS3 factors is that they represent quantum systems which are in some sense in their ground state. And that characteristic is also shared by black holes with ADS2 factors. Schwarzschild, on the other hand, is not a system in its ground state, so it's going to be a qualitatively more difficult problem. So what I'm thinking of, for example, is the good old Riesner-Nordström solution of four-dimensional Einstein-Maxwell gravity. That's one of the problems that we haven't solved. We do not know how to understand. We do not understand where the microstates indicated by the Bekenstein-Hawking formula come from. And I'd also like to add that personally, I'm encouraged by the fact that this problem has withstood 10 years of effort, because I think it means that it's an interesting problem, that it's not just going to be hanging another D brain around some cycle, or we're going to, you know, that it's a whole class of problems that we haven't solved. And I think that we'll learn some interesting things when we solve it. And like when we solved the problem with the ADS3 factors, the things that we're going to learn, I think, could be a surprise. Okay. So what I am after, and what I feel we have some definite results in this direction, though we haven't nailed it. What I am after is a similar formula for ADS2 geometries, and people have thought about this, of course, a lot. And one of the new ingredients in our more recent work on this is that we're not just looking for ADS2, not just trying to ADS2 geometries, but ADS2 with an electric field on it. And all the, which seems to be a different beast than ADS2 without an electric field. And it does turn out that all the examples where we want to understand the entropy, all the questions, for example, Riesner-Nordström, you don't end up just with ADS2, you end up with an electric field. Well, it could be a magnetic field, which you could then dualize to be an electric field. And we'll see that that will play an important role. And so we'd like to get a similar understanding of ADS2. And there's a lot of pieces and observations on this problem, which have to all fit together in some way. And that's what I'd like to do. All right, so now why do we want this? Well, as I just said, ADS2 is a universal factor in all near extremal, or in all extremal black hole geometries. Another sort of way at this ADS2 is that there's the famous ADS CFT correspondence, which started up here with ADS3 CFT2, and then went up, and perhaps as you go up, there are different examples. There's ADS4 CFT3, and then there's the best understood one, which is ADS5 CFT4. So going up seems to make your life simpler, whereas usually you would think that life gets simpler when you go down. But here, the same kind of hand-waving arguments which led to the family of ADS CFTs also suggests an ADS 2 CFT1. But there's a kind of question about what we mean by CFT1. Is CFT1, and I've played on both sides of the fence on this question, is CFT1, does CFT1 mean conformal? So it's something which has a representation of SL2R. So CFT1 is conformal quantum mechanics. That's a problem which has been studied. There's some interesting examples, some of them integrable and so on. Or CFT1 is equal to a half of CFT2, which is to say it's a chiral ordinary two-dimensional conformal field theory. And in this case, you have more than SL2R, you have it gets extended to the whole gross R algebra. And in this talk, it's gonna start looking more and more like this is the way that we want to think about it. Another reason it's interesting is augmenting this is perhaps, you know, in inching our way forward to understanding all the black holes, there's these kinds of BPS black holes that we haven't understood. Then what looks like it's going to be simpler, and many people have made this comment from different observation, than Schwarzschild is the so-called extremal Kerr. So the extremal, a rotating black hole, it has a maximum rotation. And when you hit the maximum rotation, you find that the Hawking temperature goes to zero, though it depends exactly which class of, but just say just in the Einstein gravity, the Hawking temperature goes to zero, but the entropy does not. So so extremal Kerr is completely. It looks very interesting because extremal, or maybe I want to call it maximal Kerr. Maximal Kerr, it's got the maximal spin. The Hawking temperature is zero, so it's a system in its ground state. But still, it's got some non-zero entropy, which we would like to explain. So this seems like a simpler problem, sort of intermediate between, you know, this is a little more complicated. This is proven to be substantially more difficult than the ones without ADS3 factors. This is, we've lost supersymmetry when we've gone to here, which is a good thing. And, you know, so it's getting us away from supersymmetry, but still we're studying something in its ground state, which we can't be doing when we're studying Schwarzschild. And in fact, I can imagine that we might hope to solve this problem, and then perhaps Schwarzschild can be understood as some kind of excited state of the maximal Kerr. Now, what's interesting about the maximal Kerr is it almost but not quite contains an ADS2 factor in the near horizon geometry. There's an SL2R symmetry, so there's something that looks like an ADS2 factor, but I guess it's the radius of the ADS2 is warped as you go around the sphere. So it's, a warped product of some kind. But it might be that, and like this case I talked about, it's an ADS2 with an electric field on it. Because from the point of view of the ADS2, the two-dimensional effective field theory, you're compactifying on the two-sphere, which is the horizon, from four dimensions down to two dimensions, and the SU2 isometry of the two sphere in four dimensions gives you SU2 gauge fields in two dimensions. When you spin the Kerr, you're exciting that. So it's like it's very similar to Kerr with an electric field. So I'm hoping that the same family of techniques will cover this. Now, as I said, I want to find a non-zero central charge for ADS2. Now, there's a big puzzle here, which is that we know that if you take, we can think of ADS2, quantum gravity on ADS2, as quantum gravity. We draw the Penrose diagram of ADS2, and we have quantum gravity on the strip. And it's manifestly the case for any two-dimensional quantum theory of gravity that if you go into conformal gauge, you can show that it's completely equivalent to a certain two-dimensional conformal field theory without gravity. Okay, so we've heard those words before. Well, actually, this version of them was said earlier. We've heard the words before that in ADS-CFT, what one says is a quantum theory with gravity. It can be recast as a quantum theory, has another representation as a quantum theory without gravity. Here it sounds like I'm saying that in a completely different sense, but in fact, as things develop, I think we'll see that they're not as different as you might have expected. That these two theories I'm going to argue are differ by kind of a topological twist. Now, so the quantum, but what's puzzling, so we know that 2D quantum gravity in any context, including ADS2, is equal to a 2D CFT, but because we started out over here with a theory without ghosts, sorry, a theory with diffeomorphism invariants, we can't have an anomaly in diffeomorphism invariants, so after we include ghosts, it has to have C equals zero. So there's already a conformal field theory lurking around here. But unlike what Barnard and Hanau found, is a conformal field theory with C equals zero. And conformal field theories with C equals zero are a little bit nasty. They can't have unitary representations. There has to be some sort of negative norm field floating around there. So we don't think that this conformal field theory is likely to be, as it stands, is likely to be useful, likely to have anything to do with microstates of the black hole. But let me call this is really a bulk two-dimensional conformal field theory, right? It's just the bulk theory rewritten in different variables. But what we're gonna argue is that there's a twist of this theory that has a non-zero central charge, which is what we want to be thinking about. Now, so that's all by the way of general issues and motivation. Now, I want to make two different kinds of observations. So we could try to get at this problem by taking ADS3 and compactifying. It's well known that if you take ADS3 and you do a compactification where you divide out by some discrete action that lives in just the left of the SL2R, that you get ADS2, and of course plus the Kaluza-Klein electric field. And okay, so why can't we just take, we started out in ADS3, you would think we could take the C equals 3L over 2G CFT that lived on ADS3, compactify it, or in other words, take the Brown-Hanau argument in three dimensions and just compactify it and rewrite it as some kind of argument about ADS2. And now, it sounds very simple when you say it this way, but and I think that this program can be carried out, but it turns out to be devilishly tricky. And the reason it's devilishly tricky is that this compactification here becomes, when you go to infinity, the S1 that you're compactifying on becomes null. So you're doing a sort of DLCQ quantization of the boundary theory. And so that makes life rather difficult. But what, in fact, I should have said this at the beginning. I'm working with a student, Tom Hartman, on most of this. And I'm also going to talk about results in a paper that already appeared, related results in a paper that already appeared last summer with Monica Guica. So what we did, so at the end of the day, what you want to do is you want to look at how the Brown-Hanau arguments runs when you compactify it to ADS2. And then you want to phrase it in an intrinsically two-dimensional form, so that you don't, because it shouldn't. You don't want to just use it for those black holes that have ADS3 factors. You want to. I mean, we've already solved the problem for those black holes, so you want to understand how this non-zero central charge can be understood in ADS2 language. And we also have to ask, how are we going to reconcile the fact that in ADS3 we got this non-zero central charge? In ADS2, well, there only seems to be only one Virasoro algebra in sight. It's the one that reparameterizes the strip in the usual way. It has to have zero central charge. How are we going to reconcile this puzzle? And that's something that we will. I will be able to answer. Okay, so what we did instead of trying to get this completely nailed down, all the details of this compactification, is that we've done part of that, and then we've sort of guessed how it's going to go and tried to work it out. And what we're doing now is trying to work it out, having gotten some clues from looking at that problem. We're now trying to work it out in an intrinsically two-dimensional form. Okay, so now I want to make a related observation, which is sort of further motivation for pursuing this. And it's essentially a 4D version of what was in my paper with Guica. So my paper with Guica, called Wrapped M2 M5 Duality, we made an observation like this in 5D. But let me give the 4D version of it. So, because the formulas will look more familiar. So suppose we take D equals 4 Maxwell Einstein gravity. Then, so I'm not assuming string theory or anything here. So that has a solution, the extremal Riesner Nordstrom solution. And if we work in units where the four-dimensional Newton's constant is equal to 1, and rescale t, and go to a near horizon region, we find that ds squared goes to q squared, and we define r as 1 over sigma, minus dt squared plus d sigma squared over sigma squared plus d omega 2 squared. And A goes to Q dt over sigma. Okay, and the entropy of the black hole is pi times Q squared. And so this is an entropy formula which has never been explained. So for example, in string theory, if we do a compactification in a theory where you have only the graviphoton and no vector multiplets, then you have extremal Reissner-Nordström is a, no scalars, none of all this other stuff, which you would think would make life more difficult. In fact, when I first started working on trying to understand black hole entropy, I thought, with all these extra scalars, let's take the simplest thing when there's no extra scalars or no extra, just to grab a photon. That should be the simplest case. In fact, we still don't understand that case. And here it is here. So this is a formula we can't explain. But what I want to do now is actually I just want to look at the ADS2 part here.
Yeah, the exponent's wrong on the first term. It should be 1 minus Q over R L squared.
Yes, yeah, thank you. Okay, so so what I want to do now is to notice that suppose we take so this is a two-dimensional metric on ADS2, which we get to ADS2 by compactifying on the two sphere. And so 1 over g Newton in the two-dimensional effective theory will be the volume of the tooth sphere, which is 4 pi q squared over the four-dimensional g Newton, which I've just said equal to, I've chosen conventions where it's 1. Okay, now, so that's compactifying. But now I want to lift up from a two-dimensional theory to a three-dimensional theory. And the three-dimensional theory I want to lift up to is, there is a three-dimensional geometry here in that I've got a line bundle over ADS2. And so that's some three-dimensional geometry. So the metric on that three-dimensional geometry is, ds3 squared is equal to q squared minus dt squared plus d sigma squared over sigma squared plus d phi, where this is the metric on the circle, the circle bundle, plus a squared, and A is Q dt over sigma squared. And now I can rescale phi. So phi is identified mod 4 pi. And but now I can rescale and write psi is equal to phi over Q. And psi is identified psi plus 4 pi over q. And then this all becomes q squared d sigma squared over sigma squared plus dt d psi over sigma plus d psi squared. Okay, so this is locally the metric on ADS3. So the you know, it's just like the statement that if you have a you know, that the three sphere can be written as a Hopf vibration over the two sphere, and you take the total space of a line bundle of an electric field on the two sphere, you get a three sphere. Now, if the magnetic charge is greater, you get some quotient of the three sphere. So this is just another version of that statement, except for ADS2 rather than S2. So the total space of the line bundle defined by the electric field over ADS2 gives us an ADS3, but it's a quotient of ADS3. All right, now this ADS3 is not exactly a physical ADS3, though I think we can think of the two-dimensional theory as a three-dimensional theory, but in which some of the fields are, we don't allow arbitrary momentum dependence on the fiber. It's not a fully, all the Kaluza-Klein modes aren't there. So it's not a complete three-dimensional theory, it's some kind of restricted three-dimensional theory. But let us suppose, let us take this three-dimensional theory seriously in the, for the moment. We would find that the three-dimensional Newton's constant, 1 over G3, should be 1 over G2 divided by the volume of the compactification, which is 4 pi. And so that becomes one over G Newton 3 is Q squared. Okay, so 1 over G Newton 3 is Q squared, and so the central charge then, we could associate a central charge. If we took this 3D seriously, we would take, we would get a central charge, C equals 3 L over 2 G3, which is 3 Q cubed over 2. Now, somewhere along the way here, I've lost a factor of 2. But okay, in our paper, we get all the factors right. Sorry about that. And now, the black hole, so taking this all seriously, the black hole entropy, oh, sorry. This identification of ADS3 corresponds to not ADS3 in its ground state, the conformal field theory not in its ground state, but a thermal ensemble with a temperature given by the identification, an identification divided by 4 pi squared. So this corresponds to T equals 1 over pi Q. And so I get S black hole now, if I put this all together, is equal to C over 3 pi squared times the temperature. That's the Carty formula written in terms of the temperature instead of the energy. And so this is equal to Q cubed pi squared T. The 2 isn't supposed to be there. So where T is 1 over pi, Q cubed pi squared T is 1 over pi Q, so I get pi Q squared. Sorry, I lost that 2 somewhere. But anyway, we got it right in our paper. So if you, so what is the point here? So the point is that if you take this 3D thing seriously and you imagine that there's some sort of conformal field theory associated with it, and then you apply the apply the Brown-Hanault and the Cardy formula, it reproduces this entropy. So I haven't argued that there's, I haven't given a good reason for taking this conformal field theory on the uplifted geometry seriously. That's what we're working on trying to do, but it's a motivation and a strong suggestion that there should be some kind of conformal field theory or Virasoro algebra associated with ADS2 with electric field. And I'll explain pieces of how that comes about. Any questions?
What black hole is magnetically charged? I mean, you're not going to have a few DTs, so it doesn't look like this argument is going to go through, but you would still have externality in a pi q squared.
Right. Right. So if the black hole were magnetically charged, I wouldn't know. Well, one thing I wouldn't know what to do, right?
So I don't either. That's why I asked.
Okay. Now, but one thing you could try to do is to dualize it. And maybe the statement would be that use electromagnetic duality, and then it becomes electrically charged. And perhaps the statement is that the frame in which, the duality frame in which we can see the microstates, we don't expect to be able to see the microstates in every duality frame. For example, gravity is one duality frame. We can't see the microstates there. That we have to dualize it to the electric case. I should mention here this work with Weka was actually in five dimensions, and there, of course, there are only electrically charged black holes. And the match was even better than what I've said here because we also added angular momentum, and still we got the perfect match. So yes, there are, even if we get this working, there will be more things that we want to understand. Okay. So now, let me go back and write down, let's see, does this go up or I already used it? Okay, good. Okay, now let me look at a specific action. So let's take S. So there are many, so now I want to write down some problem of ADS2 quantum gravity. And we want to write down an action which has an anti-de Sitter solution. So let's look at the one, in the end, as in the Brown-Hanault discussion, this should not rely heavily on the form of the action. But it's nice to work with a specific one. So we were working with this one, which is, and the reason we were studying this one is the one that comes from reduction from ADS3, and therefore we can compare the 2D calculations to their uplifts. E to the minus 6 phi f squared plus boundary terms plus perhaps a theta term of the form e to the minus 6 phi f. So what are we doing here? Well, it's easy to see that this has an ADS2 solution. If we look at the constant part of varying the metric, we learned that f squared has to equal e to the 4 phi times 2 over l squared. So these two things contribute in the same way to the cosmological constant. They make it negative. And then the dilaton equation of motion sets r equal to some constant here. And what you find is that there's a solution which looks like ds squared is equal to minus dt plus dt minus, where t plus or minus are equal to t plus or minus sigma, over L squared, that's the ADS radius, over 4 sigma squared, F, let me put bars for the background solutions, F bar plus minus is equal to 2E over L squared, epsilon plus minus, A bar minus is equal to minus E over 2L squared sigma, and E to the 2 phi bar is equal to the electric field E. And notice that in this, in these particular variables, that the ADS2 radius, in fact, does not depend on the strength of the electric field E. Okay, so now I want to say a few words about, is there, I raise for something. Oh, great. I want to say a word about, okay, so this is, so this solution looks like this. If we draw a Penrose diagram of ADS2, then basically it looks like this. You can have light rays which cross from one boundary of ADS2 to the other. It's basically the strip. Conformally, it's like the open string. This region, now the region outside here that we got when we took the near horizon region of Riesner Nordstrom, which is the same as the region covered by these coordinates here, is what's called the Poincaré wedge. So the near horizon geometry of ADS2 covers this Poincaré wedge region of the fully extended ADS2 spacetime. Now, I think in trying to think about what we want to understand here, we're also interested in understanding not just extremal black holes, but as we did with ADS3, we're interested in understanding the near extremal case. And the near extremal limit in ADS2 is actually quite subtle. Now, in three dimensions, if we were looking, say, near ADS3, that near extremal limit, if you look at a slightly excited black string or a wrapped black string, that corresponds to the so-called BTZ black hole, which is asymptotic to ADS3, is locally everywhere at ADS3, but differs from ADS3 by some kind of global identification. So as you go, you know, in four dimensions, here's a four-dimensional black hole solution. It has nothing to do, you know, the geometry is not, this is no cosmological constant, but if we added a cosmological constant, the geometry is not constant curvature. You can see where the metric is and so on. Now, in three dimensions, black holes are a little more subtle. There's nothing funny happening at the horizon. The horizon, you still have constant curvature. And for many years, people said, oh, you know, every solution of three-dimensional gravity is locally constant curvature. Obviously, we can't have any black holes in three-dimensional gravity. And then BTZ pointed out, and it was less obvious at the time than it seems now, that if you do these global identifications, you really need to change your mind about what you mean by asymptotic infinity. And be more careful about what you mean by asymptotic infinity. And then there is a region that light rays can't get to that should be called the boundary of a black hole. And so, you know, it took some subtle but correct arguments to understand that the BTZ black hole was a black hole. And then, of course, you find that that it obeys all the properties of the black hole, in particular has a Bekenstein-Hawking temperature and entropy and so on. The same is true in ADS2, but in ADS2 it's even more subtle. So an ADS2 black hole, we could have learned about BTZ. That's not how they discovered it, but we could have learned about BTZ by looking at near-extremal black holes that have ADS3 factors. If we look at near-extremal black holes that have only ADS2 factors, we find something a little bit different. We find that the coordinates cover, instead of covering the whole Poincaré wedge, they cover a region like this. And so the lines of constant R move along something like this. And this is what you get when you take the limit where Q goes to M, but you keep the Hawking temperature fixed. And one finds that observers moving along these trajectories have a Hawking temperature and so on, and you can throw things into an extremal black hole and make a non-extremal black hole. And so these things, and these things have non-zero entropy, which should be a laboratory for the analysis that we're doing here. We'd like to understand this near-extremal entropy of the 4D black holes. So an ADS2 black hole is really just ADS2 together with a statement about what segment of the boundary we're going to call time-like infinity. And in the extremal limit where the Hawking temperature goes to zero, that segment reaches a segment like this, which has the property that you can bounce a light ray off the other boundary and get back to it, land up exactly back in the top. So I just want to point out that these ADS2 geometries are richer than you might have think, and there's a lot of data about them that we would like to explain. Okay, so now we have these solutions, which we can think of as extremal solution. There's also a black hole solution, which is closely related. Yes?
The wedge on the other side of the non-extremal cave.
Yeah.
Is it, in some sense, a copy of the, I mean, does it have the same temperature? Or,
I think it does have the same temperature, but it sure doesn't look like it from the way I drew this.
It's kind of deceptive, that's one.
It's a conformal diagram. This is probably one of the cases where the conformal diagram is.
Presumably that scale that goes up that axis depends on the temperature, right? Because if it went right to the top, there isn't any other wedge on the right hand side, so it can't be anything there. And alternatively, if you go the other way, you shrink it to zero. So there must be, I would expect it not to have the same temperature on those grounds. It would be strange if it didn't depend on that scale. You could imagine where you chose that length from the left equals so that those wedges were of the same size. Then I would expect it to have the same temperature, otherwise not. Maybe I'm missing something here, but on grounds of continuity.
I understand what you're saying. This picture makes it look like they have different temperatures, but these pictures it sounds silly to say that they have the same temperature, but I'm just thinking about that. I'm now a little confused about it, because when I think about the solution, I think that the solution is somehow symmetric here, so I'm
But what's the significance of that light scale on the vertical axis?
Yeah.
Presumably, there must be different physics depending. Some physics must depend on that light scale.
Yeah. I'm confused about it. What you're saying is what was my first reaction to Rob's question. Yeah, obviously they have different temperatures, but then when I was thinking about the form of the solution, I think it is like very much like the.
Is there a killing flow along those?
Couldn't we have drawn the same picture for BTZ? In BTZ, there's a second asymptotic region.
Yeah.
In BTZ, there's a second asymptotic region, and we might have drawn a picture like this. Right. I mean, wouldn't we say exactly the same thing about BTZ that for the extremal BTZ, we're covering, so the extremal BTZ, or the M equals zero BTZ, I should say, is the boundary theory, which we should, this segment here is the analog of this diamond that's pasted on the M radius cylinder. And then when we make non-extremal, these things no longer beat, and you get another diamond appearing here. And so that argument would lead you to believe that the second region but there's something wrong with you. We know BTZ is not. So I don't see what's. It could be that this. Yeah, I don't know.
So can I ask, is that?
I don't know the answer. Good question.
Is there a killing flow along the lines of constant release? Or, well, maybe we should. I'll ask you after the talk.
Yeah, there's a killing flow along the lines of constant release.
Because there's a sense then in which the surface gravity is the same everywhere on those horizons on both sides. But
yeah, but there's a killing flow.
Application of that hex normalized. But why don't you go on?
I don't know. There seem to be two ways of looking at it that give different answers. Okay. Where's the singularity? I mean, there isn't a singularity. Neither is there a singularity in BTZ if you have regular momentum. So a black hole need not always have a singularity. So a black hole is you know, if you look up in the textbooks, they'll say the horizon of the black hole is the boundary of the region from which light rays can escape to infinity. It has to do with causal structure. So, in most situations, there aren't. In most situations, there isn't really much choice about what you call infinity. In the standard Schwarzschild four-dimensional black hole, there isn't much choice of what you call infinity. In BTZ, I forget exactly how it goes in BTZ. You know, there's no singularities, but there is something funny going up on the boundary up here. So you announce you don't want to, maybe start getting closed time-like curves or something.
So it's a singularity in the sense the identifications destroy the causal structure.
So you announce that you announce that but in the non-rotated case there's an actual curvature singularity.
conical.
Yeah, a conical thing. So you don't have much choice. Here, it's an infinite distance from any point on the boundary to any other point on the boundary, because distances are going to infinity. So it's unclear what you should do, what you should call time. And what I'm saying is that what an ABS2 black hole is just a choice of a boundary segment at infinity, and you're going to call that your whole region. Now, sometimes that choice is forced on you when you get this as the near horizon limit of a a 4 degree Stern Nordstrom black hole. That this is where the quark T, if I were to take a near extremal version of this, give it a mass greater than the charge, compute the Hawking temperature, keep that fixed, and then do the near horizon scaling, I would end up with not this whole region here, not this whole wedge here, I would end up just with this. And so I want to call that a two-dimensional black hole. And if I do call that a two-dimensional black hole, I get entropy, I get a Hawking temperature, the laws of thermodynamics. So it's a useful generalization to two dimensions of things that we've been doing in higher dimensions. That's mine. Okay. So, wow. I've been kind of running at the mouth a lot here. So, the sort of the important part I haven't really said yet. So let's take this theory now, and we have to discuss, maybe I'll use this board here. So let's take this solution and gauge fix it. And there are many different ways to do it, but a nice way to do it is to write, to say that ds squared is equal to e to the 2 rho dt plus dt minus. And also d plus, so that's conformal gauge for the metric, d plus a minus plus d minus a plus is equal to 0, which implies that a plus or minus is locally plus or minus the gradient of a scalar, which I'll call eta. Okay, and now if we do that naively, we have residual symmetries, which is gauge symmetries. Delta A plus or minus equals
the electric field to 0.
No. Oh. There's a plus sign here. This is Lorentz gauge.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
So we have symmetries. Delta A plus or minus is equal to D plus or minus theta, where theta is equal to theta of T plus theta of T minus. And we also have diffeomorphisms. And also the conformal diffeomorphisms, zeta plus of T plus, zeta minus of T minus. Now, okay, so now here, this is, I know it's the end of the hour, but this is sort of the important point here. Naively, we would say that we want to restrict the diffeomorphisms to preserve the boundary, which is at sigma equals zero. So this is the usual statement that when you have a theory on a strip, that you don't want to move the boundary, you want to consider the diffeomorphisms that don't move the boundary of the strip. And then also we would have some boundary conditions on theta of t plus and theta of t minus. But there's a problem with this. And then we would construct Virasoro generators that implemented these symmetries. Let's call them t minus minus and t plus plus. And those Virasoro generators would have to have central charge zero, because the stress tensor of a conformal field theory, but it's a conformal field theory that was got by gauge fixing gravity, and so we have to have central charge equal to zero. I should have referenced this, but this was discussed, I guess, in the late 80s by people like David and Zamolodnikov, and I can't remember who else. Okay, so now it's not quite, whoops, I don't want to erase this. And I can't move it. So let me go back over here. But now we get into trouble because the fact that A is diverging at the boundary. See, A is going like 1 over sigma at the boundary. And so what you find happens is, so you might say, okay, let's take A equal to its background value, A naught, plus some fluctuation A plus or minus, and we will say that A plus or minus we want to go like order sigma. So we say we want it to vanish on the boundary. Okay, what happens is that because of the divergence, if we take the Lie derivative, we look at how A changes under a coordinate transformation, we see that the Lie derivative of A plus or minus gets an extra term. Because of this divergence here, A going like 1 over sigma, we have to worry not just about how the diffeomorphisms obey on the boundary, but what their first derivatives are away from the boundary. And so we get a kind of anomalous term here, which is that Lie derivative A plus or minus, just working out the standard Lie derivative rule, is going like E over 2 D minus squared. This would be just of, say, A minus. So the extra term is E over 2 D minus squared zeta minus. So the natural boundary condition we would want to impose is not invariant under diffeomorphisms. But we can fix that up by adding a gauge transformation. And the gauge transformation we need to add, it turns out, is we need to take theta of t plus is equal to E over 2 d minus zeta minus. And there's a minus sign here, theta of t minus is equal to minus E over 2 d minus theta minus when you work it out. So what I'm saying here is that you can't set up the Hilbert space in such a way that you get a good representation of this Virasoro algebra. You need to take the Virasoro transformations and you need to add to them this extra gauge transformation. And so, and in fact, it's a chiral gauge transformation because of this minus sign. So we have something like T tilde minus minus. So these things would be generated by T tilde minus minus plus E over 2 D minus J minus, where J minus is the generator of the gauge transformation. So you see, if we have, if this is the generator of the gauge transformation, we put the parameter zeta minus in there, we integrate by parts, and we'll get this gauge transformation law. And T tilde plus plus is equal to T plus plus minus E over 2 D plus J plus. Now, this is, though I've phrased it in purely two-dimensional terms, this is a reduction of the Brown-Hanault argument in three dimensions. And indeed, it turns out that if you take the, in this reduction from ADS3 to ADS2, if you take the generators, the right-moving Virasoro generators, and you reduce them, you don't get, you might have thought that they reduce. It's true that, so here's the strip. It's true that the SL2R of ADS3 becomes the SL2R of ADS2. But it's not true that the Virasoro generators of ADS3 become the Virasoro generators of ADS2. They become twisted Virasoro generators. So the point here is that there's two stress tensors we want to think about in two dimensions. One is the one that sort of locally generates diffeomorphisms. But that one, and that's the one that's required to have C equals zero. The other one is the one that you can implement on the Hilbert space, and that's a kind of twisted Virasoro generator. And it's twisted by the U1 current, which is always going to be present as long as you have an electric field. And again, I stress that even though I got my inspiration from three dimensions, I managed to phrase this in purely two-dimensional terms. So what we're, now, here's the nice part. This guy has to have zero central charge by diffeomorphism invariance, but the twisted stress tensor doesn't have to have zero central charge by diffeomorphism. So possibly we can have our cake and eat it too here. In other words, have a stress tensor with zero central charge that comes from diffeomorphism invariance, but the real stress tensor that acts on the physical states could have non-zero central charge. So we're sort of midway in computing what this central charge is. But let me stop there.
Any questions?
There are no questions. Let's thank the speaker for what I